Hello, and welcome to Audio Readers Sports Show. My name is Dee Dee Eccles. Today we'll read from Sports Illustrated and a variety of other sports sources. Report: Chargers Herbert to undergo tests after apparent rib chest injury. By Zach Coons, Sports Illustrated. Chargers quarterback Justin Herbert is set to undergo a battery of tests after suffering an apparent rib injury during Thursday night's 27-24 loss to the Chiefs, according to NFL Network's Ian Rappaport. Los Angeles coach Brandon Staley said that Herbert underwent x-rays on his chest following the game, which are believed to have come back negative, per Rappaport. However, there is no definitive answer on the extent of the injury as of Friday morning, prompting the Chargers to conduct further testing throughout the day. A couple of important things here. Just because the x-rays are negative, if that is the case, doesn't mean he's out of the woods, Rappaport said on NFL Network Friday morning. There is rib cartilage issues, which we've seen can actually be more painful. There's internal injuries, which is obviously the most scary, and we're not going to know until he goes through a battery of tests today. Herbert battled through noticeable pain after taking a hit to his midsection on a tackle by Chiefs defensive end Mike Dana, who just over 5 minutes remaining. After retreating to the sideline for just one play, the 24-year-old quarterback returned to the field and finished the game. Even after the injury appeared to take place, Herbert was remarkably effective. He threw a late touchdown pass to wide receiver Joshua Palmer and did his best to lead Los Angeles back from a 10-point deficit in the closing minutes. The third-year signal caller ultimately came up just short, but finished the game 33-48 for 334 yards, 3 touchdowns, and an interception. It was a tough game, Staley said after the loss, per NFL Network's Bridget Condon. You're not going to see a quarterback in any level of football play tougher. There's nobody that can do what he can do. Depending on the severity of the injury, Herbert will have a chance to return in Week 3 after the Chargers have a few extra days off. Los Angeles won't play again until it faces the Jaguars on September 25th at 4:05 p.m. Eastern Time, giving the star quarterback a bit of extra time to rest up before attempting to get back on the field. 4 takeaways from the Chiefs' 27-24 win over the Chargers. Here are 4 takeaways from the Chiefs' second game of the 2022 regular season by Jordan Foote, Sports Illustrated. The Kansas City Chiefs' Week 2 matchup against the Los Angeles Chargers had a ton of hype surrounding it in the days leading up to the game, and it got off to an unexpected start. The first half, after all, featured a ton of mistakes by both teams and just 17 combined points scored. Things still seemed odd coming out of the halftime break, although the action began to heat up toward the end of the third quarter. In the end, the Chiefs did exactly what they needed to do in order to start the 2022 season off with a 2-0 record. It wasn't pretty, but Kansas City won by a final score of 27-24. Here are 4 takeaways from Thursday's game. 1. The first half was ugly for both sides. So many elements of the first half can be picked apart for both the Chiefs and the Chargers. The Chiefs' play calling at best was suspect. The Chargers and head coach Brandon Staley, known for being one of the more aggressive fourth down teams in the league, unexpectedly backed down on multiple occasions. Neither team executed at a high level. Just about everyone anticipated a high-flying, high-scoring first half and instead was met with struggles with consistency, decision-making, and putting the ball in the end zone. In all, it was the first 30 minutes to forget for two clubs that should be battling it out for AFC West supremacy throughout the year. 2. Kansas City had its hands full against Mike Williams. Speaking of an ugly first half, cornerback Rashad Fenton struggled immensely to slow down Mike Williams early on. As previously noted on Arrowhead Report, Williams has enjoyed tremendous success as of late against the Chiefs. Fenton's inability to keep up in coverage led to multiple catches and a very costly defensive penalty near the goal line. Rookie Jalen Watson also had trouble containing Williams, who went over 100 yards and had a touchdown in the game. the Chiefs' defensive scheme doesn't always bode well against big-bodied weapons or offenses that are willing to throw outside the numbers, see Bengals, Cincinnati. And this was another example of that. Once Keenan Allen rejoins the fold for Week 11's rematch between these two teams, the Chiefs' secondary will look to get off to a better start. 3. The Watsons stepped up in a big way. Once Mecole Hardman briefly exited the game in the third quarter due to an apparent left ankle or foot injury, the Chiefs needed someone else to step up and help connect with quarterback Patrick Mahomes. That player turned out to be wide receiver Justin Watson, who hauled in an alien-like throw from Mahomes deep down the field for a 41-yard touchdown. On defense, the aforementioned Jalen Watson picked up off of a Justin Herbert pass in the fourth quarter and ran it all the way back for a touchdown. That's 14 points created by players who weren't supposed to play major roles heading into the season. In a game that had weird vibes surrounding it all night, Kansas City had to be thrilled with whatever help it could get. Chris Jones very well could have gotten a section of his own, but alas, this is limited to 4. 4. The Chiefs are in the driver's seat in the AFC West. Heading into the 2022 campaign, a lot was made of how difficult the Chiefs' schedule was to start the year and how difficult it would be to establish a rhythm early on with so many new faces on the team. While the schedule remains brutal and Week 2 featured everything but a rhythm, securing a 2-0 start to the season and capping that off with a win over a divisional opponent is huge. The Chiefs' grit they displayed against the Chargers will help them all season long and potentially into the playoffs, and they got off to a great start en route to securing sole possession of first place in the AFC West. That's worth noting, especially considering the team now has 10 days until its next game. 3 Chiefs Week 2 snap count trends that stood out. Multiple things jumped off the Chiefs snap count page following their win over the Chargers by Jordan Foote, Sports Illustrated. The Kansas City Chiefs faced some trouble, but they ended up snapping out of an early funk to complete a double-digit comeback against the Los Angeles Chargers on Thursday night. Week 2's contest, a 27-24 affair, saw Kansas City and L.A. struggle to establish anything even beginning to resemble consistency. Brandon Staley and Andy Reid's squads battled all night long, but in the end it was the Chiefs that were able to step up on both sides of the football and make some plays. Now that snap counts are out, courtesy of the NFL Game Statistics and Information System, what trends jumped off the page this week? Let's take a look at 3 notable takeaways from another week of usage in Kansas City. The running back split, again, was interesting. In Week 1, the Chiefs' running back splits were a bit slanted due to the nature of the team's blowout win over the Arizona Cardinals. With that said, Clyde Edwards-Helaire and Jerick McKinnon logged an identical snap share in the game with 27 snaps apiece. Rookie Isaiah Pacheco, who came on strong in the fourth quarter, logged 16 reps overall. This week, things were just as interesting, but for different reasons. Edwards-Helaire and McKinnon were again close, with the latter outsnapping the former on offense by 2 plays. There were rumblings about Edwards-Helaire possibly injuring his leg in the first quarter, and he did end up disappearing for a bit, but he was outstanding upon re-entering the game. It was unknown heading into the year exactly what McKinnon's role would be, although it appears through 2 weeks that he's poised to cut into Edwards-Helaire's snaps. Pacheco, on the other hand, had a poor rep in the second quarter and effectively seemed to be placed in the doghouse thereafter. It's reasonable to assume that Reed and company aren't and don't fully trust the former Rutgers standout yet due to his impatience in the run game, which could have led to his limited Week 2 playing time. This week's split won't always be the case, as was expressed a week ago, but the Chiefs' usage of their running backs remains an interesting study early in the 2022 season. Chiefs need more of Sky. After hauling in one pass for a big 30-yard gain in Week 1 and playing 13 snaps, 19% of the team's available reps, Chiefs' second-round pick, Sky Moore's production, and opportunity cratered in week two. Moore still got in plenty of work on special teams, but he logged just a pair of offensive snaps, a 4% workload. Considering that wideout Mecole Hardman suffered an in-game injury and the Chiefs' offensive game plan wasn't working well through 2.5 quarters, it's puzzling that Moore didn't get a chance to inject any possible playmaking element into the offense. Perhaps, as with Pacheco, the trust factor isn't completely there yet. First-year wide receivers in read offenses typically don't fare well, and that has been brought up time and time again by fans and media alike when discussing Moore during the offseason. That seems to be bleeding into the regular season as well, at least to start. Moore very well could and should see more targets as the year goes on, but against the Chargers, he didn't offer anything offensively. How the Chiefs implement him into their Week 3 plan of attack against the Indianapolis Colts will be worth watching. Jalen Watson and Leo Chanel seeing more playing time. Seventh-round pick Jalen Watson got the news on Monday that he was going to be starting on Thursday, and he continued to do an admirable job of filling in for the injured Trent McDuffie. After seeing an unexpected amount of snaps in Week 1 due to the second-half McDuffie injury, Watson logged 33 snaps, good for 51%. The former Washington State standout, Watson's workload increased to a 68% rate. He made the most of it, securing his first career interception and pick six. Moving forward, the Chiefs have to feel solid about where they are and with him filling in. In the linebacking core, third-rounder Leo Chanel played just 10 defensive snaps, 15% against the Cardinals, while a 12-snap increase to 22 and a jump from 15% to 29% doesn't sound like a lot. That much more playing time from one week to another is certainly notable. Chanel, who played 15 special team snaps, had one play against the Chargers offense where he got pressure and forced quarterback Justin Herbert to eat what otherwise could have been a promising play. If Chanel continues to do well, he'll likely keep seeing the field more often. Thursday was a step in the right direction for him. Patrick Mahomes details developments with new receivers. For the second week in a row, Mahomes placed an emphasis on KC having many weapons by Jordan Foote. The Kansas City Chiefs offense was very far from perfect against the Los Angeles Chargers on Thursday night, but it did enough to get the job done and come away with the win. Whether it was Patrick Mahomes' box score that didn't quite tell the truth about his performance, Andy Reid's questionable first-half decision-making, the offensive lines, struggles, or even something else, the Chiefs had several things working against them. On the evening in total, Kansas City had 6 fewer first downs than the Chargers, ran 20 fewer offensive plays, and had 82 fewer net yards. Both teams punted 6 times in a contest that many would have taken the under on 6 punts combined between the two. Coming off a blowout 44-21 win over the Arizona Cardinals in Week 1, the Chiefs regressed offensively in Week 2. They also faced what appears to be a better opponent, however, and divisional games always pose as tough outings. On top of that, working on a short week after Mahomes and company with little time to prepare. When considering that the Chiefs have multiple new pass catchers to get up to speed, that's a recipe for disaster. Instead, Kansas City managed to win, although Mahomes knew it didn't come easy with just a few days to gear up for battle. "It was tough," Mahomes said. "I felt like it was tougher than just this year, especially with new guys. You kind of need that week to prepare and get that game plan in. You're trying to add a lot of different stuff, and when it's later in the season, you can go back and pull from plays that you've already run, and to be early in the season and have to throw in a whole new game plan on a short week like that. The guys accepted the challenge. We had a couple of miscues here and there. I think that's what hurt us in the first half a lot. But I thought the guys stepped up when we needed to, and glad we get the break now, and then we can kind of get back in the normal flow of things." After targeting 10 different receiving options in Week 1 and completing a pass to 9 of them, Mahomes followed that up by targeting another 10 in Week 2 and completing passes to 9 of them, everyone ranging from Mr. Consistency, Travis Kelce, all the way to backup tight end Noah Gray and fullback Mike Burton got targeted and hauled in at least one pass. Mahomes is still learning how to adjust to having so many options to choose from, but he said for a while now that every week could come with a different in-game hero. On Thursday, Kelce and Justin Watson each had at least 50 receiving yards. Watson hauled in a key touchdown, but Mecole Hardman and Clyde Edwards-Helaire both went over the 40-yard mark as receivers. After the win, Mahomes reiterated what he's already been saying, it's going to be someone new pretty often. I think that's what we said going into camp, Mahomes said. It's going to be everybody. It's not going to be just one guy. Justin Watson came in when Mecole Hardman was a little banged up, and he got McCole's route, and he won against a Pro Bowl, all-pro corner. And so for guys like that to make their imprint on the game, that'll help us out as we get into these tough games like this, that we can get touchdowns and stuff like that from everybody. Following last week's 5-touchdown performance from Mahomes, Chiefs Twitter was set ablaze when it learned that Mahomes wasn't even in the top 5 highest-graded quarterback performances of the week from Pro Football Focus. In fact, once Monday night's game between the Denver Broncos and Seattle Seahawks ended, Mahomes sat at number 9 with 74.2 grade. Most folks could tell that something was off given how terrific Mahomes played, but many of those same people, including this writer, didn't think he paid attention to PFF rankings. Apparently, Mahomes does. After helping push the Chiefs to victory, his final comments on Thursday night ended with him poking fun at the outlet that continues to underrate him. I'm sure PFF will have me at a low grade for that, but I'll keep it rolling. Chiefs legend Len Dawson's funeral services held Friday. Kansas City, Missouri, Joseph Hennessy, KCTV, Kansas City. Hundreds of people took part in person and online for Chiefs legend Len Dawson's funeral late Friday morning in Kansas City. The Super Bowl-winning Chiefs quarterback funeral services were held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Country Club Christian Church on Ward Parkway. Dawson died 3 weeks ago at the age of 87. His family requested that instead of donating flowers, donations be made to the University of Kansas Health System in support of nursing scholarships. Those donations can be mailed to 2330 Shawnee Mission Parkway, Suite 305, Westwood, Kansas, or online at giving.kansashealthsystem.com. His obituary stated he was a quiet but caring husband, father, brother, uncle, and friend. Lenny the Cool was a sports legend who brought great pride to Kansas City as the Chiefs quarterback from 1962 to 1975. The 90-minute service featured speakers, including Chief Chairman and CEO Clark Hunt, TV and radio sports announcer Kevin Harlan, Pro Football Hall of Fame Chiefs legend Bobby Bell, Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver, and more. He is celebrated for his 50-year broadcaster at KNBC-TV, 24 years as the host of HBO's Inside the NFL, NBC's analyst and color commentator. The Pro Football Hall of Fame and Super Bowl champion quarterback is also the longest-tenured sportscaster in Kansas City radio and television history. I am the seventh son of a seventh son, and all my life they said, hey, that's great, that's good luck. Those who loved Len Dawson said goodbye and good luck to the Super Bowl-winning quarterback Friday as he was laid to rest. For decades, Len Dawson was the cornerstone of Kansas City's favorite football team, leading the Chiefs to the team's first Super Bowl in 1967 and the first Super Bowl win in 1970. PayPal poised to end Suns sponsorship unless Sarver steps down, by Daniel Chavkin, Sports Illustrated. In wake of Robert Sarver's suspension after an NBA investigation into his conduct as owner of the Suns, the team is in danger of losing sponsorship dollars. PayPal, which has 1 year remaining on a deal as Phoenix's jersey patch sponsor, announced it will not renew the pact if Sarver remains the owner. PayPal is a values-driven company and has a strong record of combating racism, sexism, and all kinds of discrimination, the company said in a statement. We have reviewed the report of the NBA League's independent investigation into Phoenix Suns owner Robert Sarver and have found his conduct unacceptable and in conflict with our values. PayPal's sponsorship with the Suns is set to expire at the end of the current season. In light of the findings of the NBA's investigation, we will not renew our sponsorship should Robert Sarver remain involved with the Suns organization after serving his investigation. However, PayPal made sure to give credit to the minority leadership within the Suns organization. Head coach Monty Williams, general manager James Jones, assistant general manager Morgan Cato, and senior vice president of people and culture Kim Corbett. On Tuesday, the NBA suspended Sarver for a year and fined him $10 million after the league found that he engaged in inappropriate conduct as owner of the Suns and the WNBA's Mercury. Among the NBA's findings included Sarver saying the N-word at least 5 times, directing inappropriate comments toward women, and acted inappropriately physically toward male employees. ESPN first reported Sarver's inappropriate conduct in November 2021, and the NBA opened its investigation soon afterward. However, the league said in a statement that it didn't go further with its punishment because it believed Sarver's behavior was not motivated by racial or gender-based animus. Despite the NBA's suspension, many figures around the league have said the sanctions aren't enough. LeBron James, Chris Paul, and Suns minority owner John Najavi all said they believed the NBA needed to punish Sarver more severely. Fox's Aaron Andrews details death-defying experience by Zach Kuhns, Sports Illustrated. Before Fox reporter Aaron Andrews prepared to work the Week 1 game between the Packers and the Vikings, she revealed that she had a terrifying experience. In the latest episode of her iHeartRadio podcast, Calm Down with Aaron and Charissa, with co-host Charissa Thompson, Andrews explained that her driver fell asleep at the wheel when she was on the road from Chicago to Green Bay for a sit-down interview with Aaron Rodgers. At the time of the incident, she was on a conference call with fellows Fox broadcasters Kevin Burkhardt and Greg Olson, as well as members of the Packers, including Rodgers. "I'm typing, headphones are working, we're good. I hear snoring," Andrews detailed. "I know it's not Greg Olson, Kevin Burkhardt, or Aaron Rodgers snoring. It's my driver who fell asleep at the wheel on a highway from Chicago." Thompson interrupted at that point. "Time out, what do you mean he fell asleep at the wheel?" "Snoring, sleeping," Andrews reiterated, "and the car is moving 65 miles an hour. I am so thankful I put my phone on mute because we're on a Zoom. I put my phone on mute and I go, 'Are you effing sleeping?' Wakes up Clark Griswold. It was awful. So now I have the quarterback of the team I'm trying to work on. I'm trying to take notes. I have full-blown anxiety. This is not the way I want to go down. This is not the way I want to die." Andrews continued, saying she remained on the phone but was stressed about her situation during the remainder of the call. When she hung up, she asked the driver to pull over and get a coffee. "After Aaron Rodgers gets off, I go pull over at a Starbucks," she said. "I make him pull over at McDonald's. I go in, I get him a coffee. He doesn't drink it. The entire car ride, I'm like, ahem, 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 monitoring if he's asleep at the wheel." Thankfully, Andrews was able to make it safely to Green Bay for her interview with Rodgers on Friday. From there, she went on to Minneapolis for Sunday's NFC North game. Report: Texas spent over $600,000 to land Arch Manning, other top recruits by SI staff. The Longhorns football program reportedly spent almost $630,000 over 2 recruiting weekends this past summer, including on quarterback Arch Manning's official visit, according to The Athletic. Manning, the top recruit and nephew of former NFL stars Peyton and Eli Manning, and 8 other recruits visited Austin during the weekend of June 17th. According to invoices obtained by The Athletic, Texas spent almost $280,000 on that weekend alone, including rooms at a 5-star hotel, open bars for parents, food and entertainment, like a visit to a Topgolf driving range. The visit apparently paid off, as Manning and his high school teammate, 3-star tight end Will Randall, both committed to the school within days of their official visit. 12 of the 14 recruits that visited the following weekend, when the school, according to The Athletic, spent over $350,000, committed to Texas. In all, The Athletic reported that 16 of the 23 combined recruits that visited over the 2 weekends landed with the Longhorns, accounting for almost 2/3 of their 2023 class, and ranks them 2nd overall behind Alabama per 24/7 Sports. The opening of the name, image, and likeness floodgates has put even more pressure on schools to spend more to land top talent and keep up with college football's powerhouses like Georgia and Alabama. LSU, Georgia, Alabama, Clemson, and Virginia were among the programs Manning was considering before choosing the Longhorns. He will be the only person in his family to not commit to an SEC school, that is, until Texas and Oklahoma leave the Big 12 and join the conference in 2025. His father, Cooper, and grandfather, Archie, both went to Ole Miss along with Eli. Peyton attended Tennessee. Manning was one of the most highly touted recruits in recent memory. In his 3 years at Isadore Newman in New Orleans, he threw for 6,307 yards and 81 touchdowns while rushing for 742 yards and 19 scores. Buccaneers provide injury update for wide receiver Chris Godwin by Zach Coons, Sports Illustrated. The Buccaneers and Tom Brady are hoping to shake their less than spectacular recent record against the Saints as they travel to New Orleans for an early season NFC South battle this weekend. However, Tampa Bay will have to stave off its division rival without one of its key offensive stars. The Bucs announced Friday that wide receiver Chris Godwin will not play in Sunday's tilt after suffering a hamstring injury in last week's season opener against the Cowboys. Godwin did not participate in practice at all this week, casting doubts on his status for the Week 2 matchup against the Saints. Godwin, who returned in Week 1 against Dallas, suffering a torn ACL and MCL against New Orleans in Week 15 last year, left Tampa's season opener after appearing to tweak his hamstring near the end of the first half. He was ruled out for the remainder of the game after making 3 receptions for 35 yards. With Godwin unable to take the field this weekend, Brady will need to rely on veteran receivers like Mike Evans, Julio Jones, Russell Gage, and Breshad Perriman, all of whom are listed as questionable to play on the team's final injury report of this week. The Buccaneers will take on the Saints at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday in New Orleans. Tennessee Vols dismissed 2 football players following arrests, per report by Zach Coons. 2 Tennessee football players have been dismissed from the team after separate arrests on domestic assault charges, team spokesperson Bill Martin told the Knoxville News Sentinel. Linebacker William Mohan and offensive lineman Savion Herring were both dismissed by Josh Hoople, Martin said Friday. Mohan, who was arrested in South Knoxville and suspended indefinitely, has been permanently off the team since September 5th, according to Martin. Herring, who was arrested on a charge of domestic assault this week, was recently dismissed. Mohan, a Michigan transfer, played in 12 games last season for the Vols, primarily on special teams. Herring, a junior college transfer, joined Tennessee this summer and participated in preseason practice. Neither had played in a game this season. Number 15 Tennessee will play Akron on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Dan Marino considered leaving Dolphins to chase Super Bowl title by Daniel Shavkin, Sports Illustrated. Last year, Matthew Stafford won a Super Bowl in his first season with the Rams, which seemed to boost the trend of quarterbacks changing teams to get better chances of winning at all. Matt Ryan and Russell Wilson were traded this past offseason and hoped to replicate Stafford's success. If this was a thing 25 years ago, then arguably the best quarterback to never win a Super Bowl might have had a different end to his career. Hall of Famer Dan Marino, who played his entire career with the Dolphins, admitted to USA Today's Mackenzie Salmon that he considered changing teams late in his career. "Yes, I definitely thought about it, to be honest with you," Marino said. "I played 17 years for the Dolphins, and they were kind of going in a new direction and a new coach, and I had offers to go play other places and really thought about it and maybe had a chance to win a championship like Matthew Stafford has done." However, Marino mentioned that ultimately he just couldn't reconcile leaving Miami after nearly 2 decades with the same team, and he decided to retire instead. "It just didn't feel right," Marino said. "I just decided I'll be a Dolphin for life, and it's worked out great." After Marino's final season in 1999, Miami hired a new coach in Dave Wannstedt and was going in a different direction. If Marino wanted to extend his career there, were opportunities elsewhere. "Minnesota was interested in me in what would have been my 18th season, and the Pittsburgh Steelers talked to me," he said. "Those two were the main teams." Marino hails from the Pittsburgh area and attended the University of Pittsburgh, so that was probably a tempting option for him. Instead, the Steelers stuck with Cordell Stewart, who had a solid bounce-back season in 2000. The Vikings, meanwhile, were looking to replace Randall Cunningham after a disappointing 1999 season and instead went to Dante Culpepper, who led the team to the playoffs that season. FIFA again denies Chile, paving way for Ecuador to remain in World Cup, by Associated Press for Sports Illustrated. Chile has lost its appeal to replace Ecuador at the World Cup in Qatar, but Friday's verdict by FIFA will likely lead the case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. FIFA dismissed Chile's argument that Ecuador player Byron Castillo was actually Colombian and ineligible to play in World Cup qualifying games. Castillo played in 8 of them for Ecuador. FIFA said its appeal judges deemed that on the basis of the documents presented, the player was to be considered as holding permanent Ecuadorian nationality in accordance with soccer's legal statutes. The verdict, which upholds a FIFA disciplinary ruling from June, keeps Ecuador on track to play Qatar in the opening game of the World Cup in Doha on November 20th. The Netherlands and Senegal are also in Group A. In silence, we continue to defend what we achieved on the pitch, Ecuadorian Soccer Federation President Francisco Igas wrote on Twitter. However, Chile's legal challenge can continue. The Chilean Soccer Federation can now appeal against FIFA's verdict to CAS in Lausanne, Switzerland. Sport's highest court can organize an urgent hearing and ruling in the 9 weeks left until the World Cup starts. Chile claimed to have evidence proving Castillo is Colombian and should never have played for Ecuador. Chile prepared its case after the World Cup draw was made on April 1 and after FIFA and Qatari organizers sold thousands of tickets and accommodation rooms to Ecuador fans. Had Ecuador forfeited all 8 games Castillo played, Chile would have risen to the 4th automatic qualification place in the South American qualifying group. Ecuador would have dropped out of contention. FIFA's legal statutes include a section on national team eligibility when a state government has granted citizenship to players. Any person holding a permanent nationality that is not dependent on residence in a certain country is eligible to play for the representative teams of the association of that country, according to the statutes. Castillo's lawyer, Andres Holguin, said the player had no doubt about the result. "We always knew we were going to win this case," Holguin told the Associated Press. "Today is a simple ratification of something we knew would succeed." The appeal hearing on Thursday was held remotely from Zurich, with only the 3 judges present. The chief judge overseeing the case was Neil Eggleston, an American who is a former White House counsel in the second administration of Barack Obama. The FIFA Appeals Committee rarely overturns a ruling by the soccer body's disciplinary committee. Chile has filed complaints against an opponent's player in back-to-back World Cup qualifying programs. In the 2018 World Cup qualifying group, Bolivia forfeited 2 games in which it fielded an ineligible player as a late substitute. FIFA got complaints from Chile and Peru about Bolivia defender Nelson Cabrera, who was born in Paraguay and had previously played for Paraguay's national team. Bolivia lost an appeal at the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which said FIFA was right to investigate even when protests were filed weeks after the games were played. That case ultimately harmed Chile. 3 points awarded to Peru lifted it above Chile and into an intercontinental playoff that it won to advance to the 2018 tournament in Russia. FIFA then wrote stricter rules for the 2022 World Cup, requiring all players in qualifying games to produce a valid permanent international passport for inspection by match officials. Royals twins feel inspired on Roberto Clemente Day, by Annie Rogers and Brian Hall. Number 21 was prominent all around Target Field on Thursday night as the Royals and Twins began their series finale, celebrating Roberto Clemente Day and honoring a player central to baseball history for what he did both on and off the field. 6 Twins wore Clemente's number 21 in their 3-2 win, including Puerto Rican natives Carlos Correa, Jose Miranda, Jorge Lopez, and Giovanni Moran. Emilio Pagan, who is of Puerto Rican descent, and Byron Buxton, the team's Roberto Clemente Award nominee, also wore the number. "It means everything," Correa said, of wearing number 21. the guy that inspired me to dream big and play this game. It's a very special day for me. You grow up in Puerto Rico learning the history of Roberto Clemente and how great he was. All the people he touched off the field is what inspired me the most, and that's the reason why I have a foundation to help others, because my idol, Roberto Clemente, did it. I just always wanted to be like him. In the Royals dugout, catcher Salvador Perez and shortstop Nicky Lopez donned number 21. Perez was the Royals Clemente Award nominee last year, and Lopez got the nod this year. "It's a blessing to wear it," Perez said. "I appreciate what he did for baseball and opening the door for the Latino community. He's an example we can follow to try to do what he did, help the community and use our opportunity here to help other people, especially where I come from in Venezuela. It's hard growing up there, so I try my best to help others." December 31 will mark 50 years since Clemente was killed in a plane crash while he was on his way to deliver emergency supplies to an earthquake-ravaged Nicaragua in 1972. Thursday was MLB's 21st annual Roberto Clemente Day, and teams across the league showed a video tribute to the former Pirate and 15-time All-Star, known just as much for his philanthropic efforts as his Hall of Fame career. Additionally, a customized tribute video for both Roberto and his wife, Vera, was shown on the scoreboard. There was also a number 21 patch on every jersey Thursday night, and the Clemente logo was on the bases and dugout cards. The Twins honored Buxton as their nominee for the 2022 Roberto Clemente Award, given annually to the player best representing the game of baseball through extraordinary character, community involvement, philanthropy, and positive contributions, both on and off the field. There is one nominee for the prestigious honor from each of the 30 MLB clubs before the overall winner is announced in November. The Royals plan to honor Lopez during next week's homestand at Kauffman Stadium. Buxton and Lopez had language on their number 21 jersey patches reflecting their nomination. "It's very special," Lopez said. "He was someone who played a pivotal part in our game. I've always said that we're given this platform to reach out and lend a helping hand, and Clemente exemplified that. So to wear the number is special, and I'm just honored and humbled by it." For Thursday's ceremonial first pitch, University of Minnesota neurologist Dr. Miguel Fiol took the mound. The Puerto Rico native follows the example of Roberto Clemente in his work regarding social and cultural issues within the Latinx community, especially that of his home island. Over the last 35 years, Dr. Fiol has created several local civic organizations to promote Latino unity, while also going on medical missions to assist with hurricane and earthquake relief efforts in various Latino countries, including Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. "Growing up in Puerto Rico, the lessons of Clemente came from everywhere to impact Korea. In school, they teach it," Correa said. "Everywhere you go in Puerto Rico, there's a Roberto Clemente stadium or ballpark. The coaches, they teach it. They make sure you know the history of the game. And just my father, he's such a baseball fan. We always talk baseball. So everywhere I was learning about Roberto Clemente." A few years younger than Correa, Miranda also was taught the history of Clemente. In their home country, Clemente is never far from people's thoughts. "He was an idol for a lot of people, like my grandpa, my dad, people that could watch him play," Miranda said. "He was a big one." How Baseball's New Rules Might Impact the KC Royals, by Mike Gillespie. Friday's not unexpected news that Major League Baseball Joint Competition Committee voted to implement three long-anticipated rule changes for the 2023 season ignited widespread media speculation about how those changes may affect the game. How the KC Royals deal with the new rules remains, of course, to be seen. Highlights of the changes are indeed interesting. The simplest one increases base size from 15 to 18 inches square. Why disturb such an established dimension? One belief seems to be that bigger bases promote safety, especially at first base. While first sackers like Vinny Pasquantino and Nick Prado gain 3 inches of position and a bit of a safety buffer on the infield side of the bag, and runners will have more room to avoid first big baseman like Pasquantino. Whether shortening the distance between first and second and third by 4.5 inches, a byproduct of the bigger bases, will spawn more stolen bases is questionable, but could happen and bolster a Royals offense that prefers attacking on the base path when they can. KC Royals pitchers will be subject to a pitch clock, and more than that. The second change, widely characterized as an introduction of a pitch clock, is more than that and more complicated and controversial than base enlargement. The new rule requires pitchers to begin their motion within 20 seconds of their last pitch and at least one base occupied and within 15 with no runners on. A ball is the consequence of violating the rule. Simple enough, but there's more. Batters can't linger too long outside the batter's box between pitches. Instead, they must be in the box ready to hit with 8 seconds left on the clock. If they aren't, it's a strike on the batter. Royals pitchers are also allowed to step off the rubber or disengage only twice each plate appearance. For example, and to avoid a balk, they can step off once and try a pickoff once, or step off twice, etc. They get two more disengagements if a runner moves up a base. What happens if a Kansas City hurler forgets and tries a third pickoff throw? If it's successful, the runner is out. If it's not, he gets the next base. Timeouts called by the team batting, injury timeouts, and mound visits won't count as disengagements. The third new rule means the KC Royals can't shift or be shifted against. The true defensive shift, what MLB calls the situational defensive realignment of fielders away from their traditional starting points, ends when the 2022 World Series ends. Well, the new shift rule won't prohibit infielders from incrementally altering their positions based on hitters' tendencies. It will wipe out more drastic and more effective adjustments. Specifically, teams must deploy two infielders to the left of second base and two to the right of that bag, and at the pitch, all four infielders must be positioned on the infield dirt. Prevailing baseball thinking holds that shifts hurt left-handed hitters more than righties. How, then, might this restrictive new rule affect some of Kansas City's left-handed bats? Fans hoping the shift ban will help Ryan O'Hearn, if he's still with the club next year, may be disappointed. According to Baseball Savant's shift statistics, O'Hearn faces shifts 75.6% of the time, but has a better WOBA, 261, against shifts than when defenses don't use them, 235. Although their sample sizes are small, the case is the same for rookies Vinny Pasquantino and Nick Prado. Pasquantino's WOBA is 353 versus shifts, which he faces 93.9% of the time, and 221 with no shift in place. Prado's WOBA is 331 against shifts, 73.7% of the time, but 245 when none are deployed when he's batting. On the other hand, their shift numbers suggest the new rule will benefit other Royals. Shifting Michael Massey 86% of the time results in a 318 WOBA, while his mark with no shifting is 324. And MJ Melendez's 430 WOBA with no shift in place is 56 points better than in the 75% of the time he hits against the shift. And in just in case fans wonder about right-handed Salvador Perez, he has a 430 WOBA when he avoids shifts, but a 280 WOBA when shifted, which happens in 77.4% of his plate appearances. Will the new rules help the Royals win more games? Time will tell, but 2023 will definitely be interesting. Cristiano Ronaldo scores his first Europa League goal by Associated Press for Sports Illustrated. Cristiano Ronaldo scored the first Europa League goal of his career to help Manchester United rebound from an opening loss in the second-tier competition with a 2-0 victory over Sheriff Tiraspol on Thursday. The Champions League record scorer converted from the spot after Jadon Sancho gave United a 1-0 lead in Moldova. It was the 37-year-old Ronaldo's first goal of the season and 699th in club competition. After failing to secure a transfer to a club in the Champions League, where he scored 141 goals, the Portugal striker had to settle for playing in the Europa League for the first time since 2002 with Sporting Lisbon. Ronaldo was given a second straight start, including last week's 1-0 loss to Real Sociedad in Old Trafford, after he was used as a substitute in 4 straight wins by United in the Premier League. Last weekend's Premier League games were postponed following the death of Queen Elizabeth II. Arsenal, another favorite of the competition, had its game against PSV Eindhoven postponed from Thursday to October 20th because of limited police resources in London during preparations for the Queen's state funeral. Though Chelsea's Champions League game against Salzburg went ahead Wednesday, the visit of a large group of PSV fans traveling from the Netherlands proved more challenging. Feyenoord recorded its first win by routing Sturm Graz 6-0, Freiburg 1-3-0 at Olympiakos for its second victory, and Monaco was upset 1-0 at home by Hungary's Ferencváros. In the third-tier Europa Conference League, Ukrainian club Dnipro 1 registered a 3-1 victory at Apollon Lesmanol, and Alkmaar beat Valdouz 4-1. Europa League. Ronaldo shot his spot kick straight, sending Sheriff goalkeeper Maxime Koval to his right 6 minutes from halftime. It was awarded after Patrick Bozo brought down Diogo Dalot. Sancho put United 1-0 ahead the 17th after collecting a pass from Christian Eriksen in the edge of the area. The game was moved from the tiny Sheriff Stadium in its breakaway home region of Transnistria that borders Ukraine after UEFA blocked Sheriff from playing there this season following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It took place in the Moldovan capital, Chișinău, in the center of the country at the Zimbru Stadium. In the same Group E, Real Sociedad needed substitute Alexander Sorloth's 80th-minute goal to beat Omonoa 2-1. Five things presented by Children's Mercy Sports Medicine Center. Sporting host Minnesota United in Saturday Showdown, September 17, 2022. By Jared Belser, Sporting KC. The midpoint of three consecutive home matches for Sporting Kansas City pits them up against Minnesota United on Saturday night at Children's Mercy Park. The match will begin 7:30 p.m. Central Time, with coverage starting 30 minutes prior on 38th The Spot with the Sporting KC pregame show. These two rivals met earlier in the season on July 13th at Alliance Field in Minnesota. After an own goal right before halftime, Johnny Russell entered as a second-half substitute and evened the score on Caden Pierre's first career MLS assist. The match remained knotted up as Sporting left the Twin Cities with a road point. Here are five things to know about this weekend's battle between Sporting Kansas City and Minnesota United. September is Childhood Cancer Month, and Saturday, September 17th, is Sporting KC's annual Kick Childhood Cancer Match presented by Compass Minerals. Pre-match, the Mazuma Plaza will hold a tailgate for former Victory Project honorees and their families, and they will be honored at halftime as well. Saturday's match will feature a commemorative edition Adidas 2022 MLS Works Kick Childhood Cancer Match Ball, Kick Childhood Cancer pre-match tops, gold corner flags, gold nets, and gold captain armbands. Fans can purchase the pre-match jersey now, and MLS will donate all royalties to the Children's Oncology Group. Kid design tees and scarves will also be sold at the match in support of the Victory Project. The Kick Childhood Cancer auction benefiting the Victory Project is also live. Fans can bid on amazing experiences and team gear to support the Victory Project and all of its efforts to help kids battling cancer and all of life's challenges. On the field, Sporting will look to ride their current streak of home results on Saturday. Sporting has won four straight home matches, outscoring opponents 12-3 in the process. Kansas City is also in the midst of a five-match unbeaten run after picking up back-to-back draws on the road against the Galaxy and Houston Dynamo a week prior. Sporting's home success began on August 6th against L.A. when Sporting lit up the Galaxy 4-2. They followed that performance up with a 4-1 chopping of the Timbers and 1-0 shaking of the San Jose Earthquakes. Their most recent triumph came over D.C. United on Tuesday night in the form of a 3-0 thrashing. This stretch has produced some incredible performances, including Willy Agata's brace against L.A., Eric Tomey's efforts against the Earthquakes, and Robert Valladares' valiant performance against D.C. All three earned spots on the Team of the Week presented by Audi in those respective weeks. Sporting KC will look to keep this up against a team they have had vast success against at home in the past. In all six trips to Children's Mercy Park in the regular season, Minnesota United have come up unsuccessful in all six. Sporting is the perfect 6-0-0, tallying 15 goals while conceding just one. Every time the Loons fly south for a regular season match in Kansas City, they are turned away empty-handed. Their lone goal came in a 4-1 defeat on June 3, 2018. Minnesota has one victory in Kansas City, a 2020 Western Conference semifinals win. The last meeting at Children's Mercy Park came on September 15, 2021, where Sporting caught Loons lacking, finding the back of the net four times. Forwards Kiri Shelton, Daniel Saloy, and Johnny Russell all scored in the first, and Cam Duke put the cherry on top in the 52nd. Now it is time for the teams to renew their rivalry. A little over 452 miles separate Children's Mercy Park and Alliance Field, making Minnesota United Sporting's closest geographic opponent. The closeness has not been the only reason for the Sporting's rivalry with Minnesota, as they have met 18 times since the Loons came into the league in 2018, more than any other opponent. Sporting holds the edge in the series, going 8-6-4 against Minnesota in all competitions. Thanks to the impressive home record, Sporting is 7-4-4 in the regular season against them. In 2020 at MLS is back, Minnesota took a 2-1 win from Sporting in the group stages, counting towards the club's regular season record. Shelton has shined in the series, scoring 4 goals and adding an assist in just 8 appearances against Minnesota. Russell has found a favorable matchup against Saturday's visitors as well, tallying 3 goals and 8 assists in 11 appearances. Saturday has major playoff implications. After a 2-month stretch in which Minnesota went 8-1-2, they have failed to win in 4 straight matches, earning just 1 point in that span. With that drop-off, Minnesota occupies 5th place, 5 points above the playoff line. 5th place would not host any Audi MLS Cup playoff match in the first round, and with 4 matches remaining in their season, Minnesota needs points wherever they can find them. Minnesota will be traveling to KC without star forward Emmanuel Reynoso. The Argentine leads Minnesota in goals and assists, accumulating 10 of each. He and Haney Mukhtar are the only players in the MLS with double-digit goals and assists. They will turn to forward Luis Amarilla, who ranks 2nd on the club with 9 goals and 5 assists. They will also look to all-star goalkeeper Danye St. Clair, who ranks 5th in saves with 93, to stymie the red-hot Sporting KC offense that is averaging 2.43 goals per match since the start of August. Kansas State football game feels like homecoming for Tulane coach Willie Fritz, by Kellis Robinette, Kansas City Star. It's hard to believe Willie Fritz has never witnessed a football game at Bill Snyder Family Stadium. He has so many connections to Kansas State that you would think he would have stumbled into free tickets at some point in his life or coached for an opposing team. This is a man who grew up in Shawnee and played football at Pittsburgh State. He has coaching experience at Coffeyville Community College and Central Missouri. Fritz even coached a pair of K-State greats, Michael Bishop and Quincy Morgan, before they became Wildcats, back when they were playing for him at Blinn Junior College in Texas. Quick aside, Bishop was even more dominant at the JUCO level than he was for the Wildcats. "We were 24-0 with him as our quarterback, so we was pretty good," Fritz said during a phone interview. "I remember our offensive coordinator wanted to put in a QB draw, and I told him, that's called Michael scrambling. He's already does it 8 times a game, and no one can stop him. I hope he gets into the College Football Hall of Fame. He deserves it. He elevated everything for us in Kansas State." Despite all of that, Fritz's first game day experience will come at 2 p.m. on Saturday when he leads the Tulane Green Wave against K-State in a matchup of undefeated teams. "I have been to Manhattan many times, and Coach Snyder used to let me watch practice when I wanted to check in on Michael or Quincy," Fritz said earlier this week in a phone interview. "But this will be the first time I have ever been inside the stadium. I'm excited about that." Fritz has many reasons to look forward to this game. He has 4 brothers and 1 sister who still live in the Kansas City area, and he will have close to 50 friends and family members cheering him and his team on from the Tulane section of the crowd. Needless to say, he would like to put on a good show for them. "When you come into these games, you don't really get to see anybody, except for maybe 10 minutes after the game," Fritz said. "You are in and out. That's the difficult part. We will get in Friday night, play the game, and then fly back. They will have a lot of fun and get to relax, but I will be working." Fritz is always working. The coaching journey he followed from his KC area home, he grew up near the intersection of 75th and Quivira Road, to Tulane was filled with more stops than a cross-country drive. After his playing days as a defensive back ended at Pittsburgh State, he got his coaching start as an assistant at Shawnee Mission Northwest. From there, he became a graduate assistant at Sam Houston State, then an assistant at Willis Texas High School, then a defensive coordinator at Coffeyville, then back to Sam Houston as a position coach, and then to Blinn for his first head coaching gig. That led to a job at Central Missouri, then Sam Houston State, then Georgia Southern, and finally Tulane, where he has been calling the shots since 2016. Talk about climbing the ladder. I really feel like I am very lucky to have done it this way, Fritz said. Some coaches start on third base and think they hit a triple. That's not me. My wife and I enjoyed every spot we've been at. I have great friends from all those spots. It has been very, very enjoyable and very rewarding. Let's put it this way. I wouldn't trade it for the world. The Green Wave have proven to be an excellent match for Fritz, who loves living in New Orleans. Though his overall record at the school is only 33-43, he has guided Tulane to 3 bowl appearances. No other coach in school history has led the Green Wave to more than 2. I have so much respect for Willie and what he did at Central Missouri for so long, K-State coach Chris Kleiman said. Then he went to Sam Houston and turned them into a perennial power in the FCS. He went to Georgia Southern and did some really good things. Tulane made a great hire in Willie. So much respect for Coach Fritz. He's done a terrific job down there, and he is a winner. Tulane could be a challenging opponent for K-State. The Green Wave is off to a 2-0 start that includes a pair of blowout victories over Massachusetts and Alcorn State. Michael Pratt is an experienced quarterback who has already thrown for 482 yards and 5 touchdowns this season. Tulane is also averaging 177.5 yards per game on the ground. This might be the most well-rounded offense the Wildcats have faced. But this will also be Tulane's first road game of the season. Fritz isn't the only one who experienced K-State Stadium for the first time this weekend. We're going to go up big time in level of competition this week, Fritz said. We have played well, but we need to be a heck of a lot better than we have been. I have been very impressed by Kansas State. They are great in all 3 phases. Jalon Daniels, one of 8 Manning Award stars of the week. Junior quarterback Jalon Daniels is one of 8 quarterbacks to be named to the All-State Sugar Bowl Manning Award Stars of the Week, following a 3 passing touchdown performance that led to Kansas beating West Virginia 55-42 in overtime on September 10th. Kansas to host Duke at 11 a.m. on September 24th on FS1. The Kansas Jayhawks will return home to host Duke on Saturday, September 24th at 11 a.m. The Big 12 Conference announced on Monday. The game will be broadcasted on FS1 from David Booth Kansas Memorial Stadium. Kobe Bryant named Big 12 Defensive Player of the Week. After sealing Kansas's first win against West Virginia in Morgantown on an 86-yard interception return for a touchdown, sophomore cornerback Kobe Bryant was named the Big 12 Conference Defensive Player of the Week, the league office announced on Monday. Jalon Daniels named a Davey O'Brien Great 8 list, following a 3 passing touchdown performance that led Kansas to a thrilling 55-42 overtime victory at West Virginia on September 10th. Kansas quarterback Jalon Daniels was named to the Davey O'Brien Great 8 list for week 2 of the college football season. That's all the time we have for this edition of the Sports Show. My name is Dee Dee Eccles, and thanks for joining me.